So why don't you guys introduce yourselves and tell us how the Chimps got its start?
Okay. Well, I'm Scary Carey. I play lead guitar.
I'm Sonic. I play the bass guitar.
And the Chimps actually have been started about, I guess we could say, about 10 years ago, but as a full unit, we've been together for about 5 years as this unit, like these members, and it's been going strong, and it's been a great unit. So really as a business, I think we kind of, you know, the band's got to work their things out. I think as a business, we really started moving about 5 years ago with more touring and connections, because we're a great group of members that just are all on the same page and have the same goals. And so that's pretty much about when we got started. And we all met through friends of other bands. Like, we were in other bands, and we kind of all met that way, just being fans of each other. And then, you know, openings came up, you know, people left, a guitarist for other reason, and then a bass player. And then, so when those openings came up, we all kind of, you know, teamed up. We called each other and like, hey, let's do this, you know, and cool. We got a great vision, and we happened to click really well musically, you know, just with the writing and the songs.
So you guys are together, what, with it, you know, like as of right now, what will be called in the future, the classic lineup?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. Well, it started off with a bunch of friends jamming in living rooms and, you know, doing backyard parties and local bars and stuff like that. But, and even at that time, the original members were Cappy, our drummer, and Artemis, our lead singer. You know, Carey was in a different band. I was in a different band. I've actually been in more bands with Carey than probably anyone I know. Yeah. But yeah, 5 years ago was when, you know, the members were disappearing and getting replaced. But it was kind of like the all-stars of the San Fernando Valley got together and said, all right, we're going to do this for real.
Yeah, that's pretty much how it happened. And again, we were fans of each other, and then just were like, I'd like his style, I like his style. And so let's see how it sounds together.
Now, you guys have like a really killer sound, because I mean a lot of bands that mix, you know, I guess you could say mix hip hop with rock, like, utterly fail, but you guys have nailed it.
Thank you, brother.
Thanks,
you
know? Man.
Well, because yeah. I mean, think about it. If that's a road you want to go down, you seriously risk being a parody at some point. You know, and I mean, you guys have brought cred to it.
Thanks, man. That's actually a challenge. That was part of one of the challenges for us. You know, it was, you know, we're fans of all the, especially that was, you know, it was a big movement starting in the late 90s, I believe, and then into the 2000s still. But we were fans of, you know, all those bands, Rage Against the Machine, Limp Bizkit, POD, you know, but a lot of other stuff too, of course, you know, Deftones, Pantera. I mean, you know, the list goes on, Faith No More. And I think that was one of the challenges. We never wanted to sound like anybody else, but it just kind of happened naturally that we have such different influences, in my opinion, that we are able. And, of course, you know, the vocals make the sound, too, things like that, you know, different style of vocals. But we just happen to be writing in a way that it comes out, you know, our own unique style. And we use elements from different things. You know, like, again, I'm a huge Pantera fan, but I'm also a huge Tupac fan, so that kind of stuff, you know, putting that together is going to sound pretty interesting.
To me, it's funny, too, is if you listen to the very first album and all the EPs and albums, like, if you listen to everything in a row, you can actually hear the evolution of this band.
Yeah.
And even with the stuff we're writing now, we're actually in the lab. We're not doing a lot of live shows right now because we just got off tour, but me and my lead guitar player, actually, we're in our studio right now talking to you. Getting ready to scratch out a full-length album, hopefully by the end of the year, and it's a whole another evolution process that I think our fans are really going to dig.
Nice, yeah, nice. Well, they were. Now let's talk about your self-titled EP, man. I first like got hooked on you guys with California because we put that in rotation last year, and I actually upped the rotation. Like your basic heavy track in the computer is supposed to be at a 6, so I upped it to a 10, so that it would play like every few hours, because I was like, man, I mean, people just got to hear this thing. I mean, because it's like, you know, like I said earlier, it's got that fresh sound, and pulling off that sound and mixing those two genres is a difficult feat. It's a Herculean task, you know, and you guys just pull it off.
Yeah, definitely, man. It's like California example. I'm into the heavy stuff a lot, you know, but then again, if it sounds good, I'll go with it, you know, and we all will. And that was just like some of those songs or riffs sometimes are just made either on the spot, like we try to, you know, we also do engineering and sit there and work things out. But that was kind of like one that kind of came up on the spot, you know, and then the vocalist kind of had a vocal idea of California, like how did they start singing that, you know, when you wake up, and it just came to Chuck, I think, and then Art kind of came up with the other part of it, and it just happened to flow. And so when we basically, you know, it worked out the way it worked out, and then, you know, even the guitar riff on the verse is a little funk. I wasn't planning on a lot of funk, but I've done funk before, so, you know, that's how it turned out, and then it sounded good, so we just went with it, and it was, you know, and then it had that commercial feel a little bit, and you always want to throw a little bit of that commercial in, but we don't try to write for that. It just turned out that way. A lot of our stuff could be sound, people might think it's underground, you know.
Now, what was it like working with Ryan Green as a producer? Because that guy's been around, man.
Yeah, so that was the second EP we did with him. It's been amazing working with him. You know, aside from just being an engineer and a producer, I mean, he's actually a good songwriter, arranger. He gives a lot of great opinions. And it's cool for us, too, because we get so locked into a lot of the stuff we write. It's really cool to have somebody outside of the box go, hey, wait a minute, maybe you should put that right over there, you know, and then actually be able to do it right in front of us so we can hear it on a playback, you know, in real time. And it actually helped us, you know, put all the last minute spicing and icing on the cake, you know?
Yeah, he's adding flavors and stuff, you know, and adding all the little, you know, the ear candy. Yeah. And so we'll bring him the tracks, and we're a great match with him, man. And he's just, that's how, you know, he's had experience in metal and punk rock and even R&B and I think some rap. And so it was a great mix, and it just happened to work, you know. And he's a great producer.
Now he's one of those dudes that's like, if I'm in a band and he's producing my band, I mean, I'm gonna like listen to everything that comes out of his mouth.
Yeah, I'm an engineer myself, and just watching the guy, it's like half the time my mouth is just wide open. I'm like, how did he, I never thought of that, like, what, you know, like he's constantly surprising me.
Yeah, as a guitarist, I'll walk in the studio and I swear to God, we'll write 20 things on the spot. I mean, you know, he can play a little guitar, but he's not, you know, he just tells me like, let's try this, or what do you think of this, you know, so we're creating on the spot, you know. It's a great feeling, man. It's like we're kind of like a Mike Patton to me, you know, like just all creativity is open, you know.
Nice. Now, being a guitarist myself, I got a, you know, my secret question, the one I can't wait to ask, man, and I know you guys, we were talking about it before the interview, but I got to know, man, you know, being the bassist and the guitarist, what's your gear?
That's funny, someone on Facebook. I just answered this question a minute ago. Well, obviously, we're endorsed by Schecter, so, you know, Schecter's laced us each down with a bunch of different customs. I've got, I think, 4 custom basses now, all 5 strings. And my rig, I'm using a Warwick Prophet 5.1. It's a 500-watt head with the full stack. You know, I got a 15-inch sub and then 2 10-inch with tweeters. And that thing's got a unique sound. I wish it was 1,000 watts. They actually don't make the head anymore. They moved on to different heads, or, you know. But this particular head has a unique sound. As long as I'm, you know, if I'm playing a venue where I can be mic'd or DI'd, you can really hear it through the PA. Yeah, that's the head I used on both albums, actually. You know, that we did with Ryan Green. It's. I mean, you can hear it. It's got a really unique sound.
Yeah, and I use Schecter guitars, of course. Yeah, we're both Schecter, so. I got a couple of them. I think I've had about, I think I still have 4, I think. And so, but two, I use 2 mainly. There's 2 mainly that I use. Again, I was telling you one is a Blackjack, I believe. And it's a 6, there's 6 strings. I stick with 6 string, but that is because we tune in E and drop D on the last albums. But, sneak information, might be dropping down to B for the album coming up.
Yeah.
But I can still do that on 6 string due to a special pedal, actual an octave pedal. So But I'm also one guitar I use mostly for the E stuff because for soloing, and we have some you know, some kind of metal solos, neoclassical metal solos in a couple of the songs. And so it's a looser feel. I kind of based it off a Gibson style Zakk Wylde guitar. Again, that's my I believe that's my Blackjack and six string. And then also I have another one, which is a newer guitar that came out. It's part of the Hellraiser series, and basically it has that Sustainiac, which they, you know, it's a new kind of pickup that you can hit a note and it can play forever. Now, not that I need to do that, but you know, it also has a feedback sound too. So it's just, you can get extra sounds or note if I textures, need some. Yeah, textures. And it's really cool just with these couple switches. I had to learn how to use them for a second, but it's really cool. I use that for drop D just because I don't solo. I use it more for those kind of songs where it's like I need different sounds and stuff like that. So that's mainly it. Yeah, and then also Bogner Amps. Got to give credit to them. Bruce Boulay, my guitar teacher and legendary from Racer X and G3 Tours and stuff, he took me into Bogner, and he was on Bogner and basically got me endorsed. And the sound has always been great. Ryan Green loves Bogner, and then it seems to be a good sound for our live shows and for recording.
What is Bruce up to now? Because, I mean, I'm a Racer X fan too, with him and Paul Gilbert and all that.
He's still doing a lot of solo albums. He's had a couple come out, and they're really good, man. You should definitely check them out if you haven't yet. They're great albums. He's got new ones. He's actually doing solo touring right now. He did a little stint with Asia. It was like a project he was in for a little bit. They did some touring, and he still gets picked up for things like that, for jobs. But
we'll actually probably be doing a show with them pretty soon, our next live show. I mean, we're going to stay local as far as live shows until the end of the year, but he lives out here as well. And we've actually, for the last year, we've been talking about doing it, just our schedules have never worked out. But it looks like probably in November, we might be able to work something out.
Nice, nice. Now, Schecter's, one thing I've heard about Schecter's that are really, really good, and since you guys are endorsed by them, and you guys are going to be in the know about this, but I've heard a lot of good things in way that if you buy a Schecter, you don't really have to tinker with it. Like, if you want one with EMGs, you can get one with EMGs. If you want one with Duncans, you can get one with Duncans, so on and so forth. Is that the case, that they're basically hot rodded out of the box?
Yeah, it's a good idea. I was taught or told you don't want to really switch pickups if you know, I mean, unless you're going for something. But with Schecters, they come with great pickups. Yeah, these EMGs and stuff are awesome. So, or Seymour Duncans are the other ones I use too. And then so basically, they come great the way they are, and you really should pick the guitar that you'd like the pickups that are on it. Unless, like, the only person I know, like, Dimebag used to switch pickups, you know, he went with these, like, Bill Lawrence, because he wanted that real, you know, gainy, you know, kind of sound for a solid-state amps that he was using back in the day and for his, you know, effect setup. But other than that, the pickups that they come with are great.
Yeah. They actually hot-rodded my last custom bass. They hot-rodded in it. You know, they're active pickups, but once the battery gets to a certain level, it automatically switches to passive. So all I got to do is adjust, you know, my tone knob a little bit if I'm on stage, if that was to happen on stage, which won't, because I usually change my batteries. But I thought that was pretty unique.
Yeah, and I was a fan of active before, but I'm actually a fan of passive more now. So after... from Bruce Boulay told me that, Ryan Green, and then just from playing, and it's just a real smooth, good sound. But, you know, active is still cool if you want that kind of gain and, you know, that aggression, you know.
I've heard that active, I don't know if this is it's true or not, because I've got one guitar with EMGs. I have a Les Paul Classic with the Zakk Wylde kit in it, and then everything else is Duncan's. But I've heard more and more people say that active is actually not the way to go for a live situation.
It's
all opinions.
It's all opinion. I think it's all your own taste, but
and what you're playing through too. Are you going through a pedal board? Are you going analog pedals?
Right.
What are you using? I think that has a lot to do with it too.
But if you want to cut out a little feedback, I would probably say passive. You know, so like at least on stage, it seems to be just that smooth sound. You know, it's just you can feel it, you can hear it. And it's just a little less maybe gain or feedback, like too much. So you can control that better at a little easier to me with passive. Mm-hmm.
I think it, in my opinion, I always thought it was always like, okay, active versus passive is kind of like digital versus analog.
Yeah, totally.
You know,
this will be a debate that'll go on forever.
Yeah. And that's why it's still personal opinion, kind of, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly, man. I mean, well, let's talk about how you guys are promoting, because one thing I've always admired about you guys is, and you guys are a brand in the truest sense of the word. I mean, you're not just a band, you are a brand. And I'm looking at your merch store, and you know, like, you know, we were talking earlier, you don't just have music related stuff. So how do you come up with ideas like that?
We're constantly brainstorming. I mean, we're a do-it-yourself band, so it's not like we have a label or a manager or a PR company delegating, okay, you guys should be doing this, you should be doing that. So, I mean, we're always brainstorming, and not just with the branding stuff. I mean, with touring and just pretty much everything. Like, we're always coming up with ideas, and, you know, I think that's how, you know, I think Chucky and Caps came up with the Chimp Espresso, you know, and then my brother got involved with the company Dragon Mouth Vapors, you know, a year and a half, year ago, whatever. And I was like, you know, one day he actually came there in North Carolina, there in Asheville. So him and his partner came to LA and we're sitting in my room and, you know, smoking and hanging out. And I just came up with the idea because he was telling me about the company. I was like, man, it'd be cool to have a chimp's juice, like a banana flavor one or something. You know, and the guy's eyes got all big, and that's kind of where it started. The idea started, you know. So we kind of back and forth it, and he had his like, they call him cook. So he had his cook, you know, make up the recipe. And once they got it, it's actually really good, you know, for people who like to vape. It's almost like hitting candy. It
tastes great. It's like gingerbread and banana flavor. So yeah, it's really good.
Nice. So, I mean, like, so in the room. So it kind of sounds like banana bread, too, in a way.
Pretty much, yeah. And we got all the nicotine levels, you know, we got no nicotine, you know, for the youngsters who are doing it these days and don't want the nicotine, or for people who are actually trying to wean off cigarettes, you know, and they get to the zero. So they have that oral fixation.
But I'll tell you what, that vape stuff works, man. Like,
yeah,
really? Okay.
Yeah, yeah. I was a 20-year smoker up until a few years ago, and I used vaping to wean off it.
Okay. Well, I was trying to talk Sonic into that, but
it's cut down. But my stress levels are hit the friggin' ceiling sometimes, and I tend to go back to smoking cigarettes, you know.
Yeah.
On my mind, I'm getting older. I definitely need to quit. And the vape does help, you know.
Yeah. I think a lot of it, you know, from one smoker to another, is the psychological, like, you know, having it in between your fingers.
Yeah, and all the triggers, man. After you eat, after sex, when you wake up, you know.
Yep. Oh, the after sex thing, I cured by being with a non-smoker, like an adamant non-smoker.
Nice.
one that's real crass and asshole-ish when you bring it up.
Right.
You know, so
yeah, don't step on toes.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and with the promise of not having that again, you know, that kind of like weans you off it too. So
yeah, definitely.
Oh yeah.
Mm-hmm. Now, how do you get, another thing that I really have mad respect for you guys is you're able to get all this promotion that other people would die for, like getting your music on Sons of Anarchy and hooking up with Bam Margera and MTV and all that stuff. How does that come about?
Well, yeah. Well, Chuck, our MC, he's been doing work for hire and TV music probably for 15 years. I actually been writing music mostly in the hip hop electronic genres for background music for TV. I've been probably doing that about 10 years. So we kind of know the language of how to talk to sound supervisors. You know, for the Chimps, the first SOA placement we actually got through our old manager, who hooked us up with the sound supervisor, and we basically kept in touch with them. You know, happy birthdays, happy Christmas, all that kind of stuff. And every time we came out with new material, we just sent it to them. And since that series did so well, you know, they went 7 seasons. We were able to get 3 different songs off 3 different EPs on there. Like every time we sent him something, he was like, "Oh, I got the perfect scene for this one." You know?
Yeah, it's like the, you know, once you get the first one to them, you know, then they were like, "Okay," like the first one, you got to kind of get in, and then once they get that, then it's like a better deal every time. Plus he's a fan, you know, like Bob Thiel, thankful to him, you know, we're a fan of him too, you know, and the Forest Rangers, his own stuff, the music supervisor and his assistant Michelle too, and then they kind of you know, became fans. So like when we send him stuff, he tries to use it, you know. So basically they found, and it worked really well apparently on race car scenes and motorcycle race scenes and
chase scenes,
anything chasing. So it was, you know, and they use the energetic kind of aggressive parts on the songs, or songs that have that.
Mm-hmm. Now, one, you know, because you're able to do all this stuff, I mean, it's obvious that you're doing, you know, that you're initiating it with networking. So what's the one piece of advice that you would have for any band on how to network?
My opinion is like, I'm real ambitious and driven. These guys know that. Like, I mean, we all are, but, and again, some of the other guys are. Again, our drummer, Cappy, you know, kind of hooked up the band Margera thing back in the day. I found a manager that helped us get a publicist to get to SOA, you know, Sons of Anarchy, things like that. So you got to get out there and talk to people, you know, and you got to get out there and be proactive. And one big thing, man, this is one thing, and this is part of what you're asking, is like, bands need to stick around for the whole show. You know, when you go to see a band play, or when you're playing that night, even if you're playing at 8 o'clock, 9 o'clock, or you're the midnight act, whatever, try to come and be there for the other bands, man, because even other bands can help you out, and their fans can help you out, and you're going to gain off their fans. And so the most successful bands I see do that, and they network. And again, we go out, man, we go to park, you got to party, you know, that's one thing I was told. You got to be willing to go to the club, to go watch your friend's band, go to events, go to even maybe a, you know, a TV film composing event, you know, music supervisor's event, things like that. But go out there, you got to go out, and it's all networking, just like in the film business, just like in the TV business, and same in the music business, you know. Yeah, so it's all connected.
The Chimps are notoriously known for being the first band in and the last band out.
Yeah.
You know, and we try to network with everyone, you know, and you know, even me personally, a lot, we played with, you know, probably now thousands of bands in the last 5 years. And some of them I don't like. I didn't necessarily like the music, but I like the members, and I like the fact that they had the balls to get on stage and do what they're trying to do, you know, and I have a lot of respect for that. So I'd still socialize with these people, you know.
And little tips, like, you know, you can get people's information, but people are shy, but whoever's in the band that's not shy, you know, get a phone number. You know, they're not going to... You give them your number, they might not call you. You know, it's just like, you know, trying to pick up a chick or something. Yeah. You know, you gotta get their number, man, because you gotta make the move.
One thing I noticed with bands too is a lot of bands will have the one guy who networks, you know,
yeah,
and then the rest of the band doesn't do so much. They might have one guy who networks physically, and then another guy who's the social media guy, and then the rest of the guys just kind of rely on those two guys, and that's not going to work. That equation is the worst formula I've ever seen.
Yep.
My band, every single member works just as hard. We all do social media. We all go out and personally network. You know, yep. We try to support as many local bands as we can while, you know, when we have the free time. They're obviously busier these days than we were 5 years ago. But we're still at it, you know, and we're all five of us are adamant about it. You know?
I've been in bands like that before. I've actually had, because I was the networker in every band I was in, and I've actually had other band members tell me, like, you know, when I asked them, will you help me, like, schmooze around and stuff? I'm like, well, I hoped you brought your cabinets in.
Yeah.
You know, I took the bottom cab in for you, man. What else you want? And I'm like, it's on fucking wheels, dude.
Like, let me go talk to people for you? No. They got it. It's also a person-to-person thing, man. It's, they got to, you know, that's, that they, people will respect you if you approach them, and they might want to work with you. So, you know, you got to go out. You just got to be, you got to try. You got to take down those walls. If you're trying to do this as a business, you got to, you know, approach it as a business. You got to be willing to network. That's the biggest thing for any business you run, you know, besides just a band.
Now, don't you think, like, a band's best support group are other bands? Because they're the ones that'll be like, that will call you up and say, you want to do a show with us? You know, stuff like that.
Definitely.
Nowadays, especially, man, because, again, you know, a lot of it's DIY. You know, a lot of the, you know, record label chaos and music industry chaos these days, it's... Bands, we're all a team, man. We should be a team. You never want to compete. You always want to help each other. You always want to, you know, like, let me help you as much as you can. You know, again, you're pretty busy with your own band most of the time, but at the same time, it's all about, you know, again, like I was saying, stay there for the show, you know, stay there to support them, you know, help them out, make friends with all these bands, all these musicians. We're all, We're all in the same game.
And that's the only way you really, you know, everyone always talks about, you know, you see all these posts on Facebook and stuff, you know, support your local music, you know. And a lot of people talk about how the scene is dead, you know, and I see this in different cities all over the country. And yeah, the scene is kind of, I mean, I grew up when the scene was flourishing here in Cali, here in Hollywood, you know, and I watched it die. It broke my heart. And then I remember the first time we went to Arizona was when I got a hint of like, wow, they actually got a scene out here, you know? So if you want to really build your scene, then you have to be, you know, you're going to have that camaraderie with other band members, you know, set up shows with them, you know, keep in contact. Don't rely on some whack promoter to, you know, invite you to a show and you don't know who you're playing with. You know, it's better if you have a camaraderie, you know, because that's how we do it out here. You know, we try to book our own shows with all our homie bands, all our friend bands, and we don't promote it as a show. Like, hey, come check out our concert. We throw it like, hey, we're throwing a party tonight at this place. You know, that, and we try to keep everyone from the beginning till the end, you know, so everyone gets their shine time. Yeah. And everyone has a great time, you know.
Exactly. Now, do you think that maybe social media and the invention of the internet kind of killed the local scene and made it wider, and then now it's a little bit diluted? Because I remember, see, I'm 42 years old, so I was in the early 90s music scene when I was like first getting into bands, and literally the only guys that my age that weren't in bands were the ones that knew Star Trek was on Friday night, you know, and that right. was their priority, you know. I mean, so.
I'm definitely in the same era as you, so I can definitely relate to that.
Well, I know if you mean social media, like in a general aspect of like entertainment, I mean, I was just, it's funny, you know, you see these, you know, Blabbermouth and articles and stuff and Loudwire maybe, like, but Gene Simmons is, you know, saying rock is dead and things like that, or Bruce Dickinson from Iron Maiden just said something about, you know, how his sons are being affected as artists as well. And it's, yeah, the era's changed, man. And so it's so, you know, DIY these days. And what you got to do, though, and, you know, these we appreciate that these older musicians, you know, consider what's going on in the music business. But at the same time, you just got to learn new tactics and ways to work around it and be a strong DIY, do-it-yourself band, you know. Yeah. So you got to learn new ways to work with it. Okay, our angle is, you know, we're getting work with TV shows. Our angle is we're going to tour on our own. We're going to, you know, we're going to network with these bands so we can tour with these bigger bands. And you got to work hard. You got to work hard, man. That's the only way you're going to stick out in a world that's saturated by you know, video YouTube fights and and video you know, and whatever else is big, you know, or you know, models and all that stuff, you know.
Yeah, to answer your question, though, I don't think the scene in LA died before the internet was even around. So, if anything, I think the internet could help, you know, bringing back a local scene if people knew how to use it the right way, I guess.
I think what the internet's doing is making the term local obsolete, because you can be in Buffalo, New York and have fans in Japan.
Yeah, that's the thing. Is again, the social media, I think it's positive, you know, because that's how we connect with our fans, man. It's so
easy. Yeah, it's funny too, because when the Chimps relate, when we talk to each other about, okay, guys, you know, we're gonna write this album until the end of the year, we're gonna stay local. Local doesn't mean here in LA. Local to us could be all the way to New Mexico and back, San Diego back. Like, we have these little roots that we do, you know.
Yeah.
And that's still local to us. You know, if it's a 6-8 hour drive, that's to us it's considered local scene that we've done, you know, the whole national, you know, driving all the way to the East Coast and back.
Now, do you think the internet is, or I would actually say social media is more befitting to the music scene? Because one of the things I notice is that, you know, it's kind of polarized the major labels, and people aren't into getting a record deal like they used to.
Well, record labels
aren't the same.
They're not given as big as advances as they did back in Bruce Dickinson's time.
Yeah, there's no development deal anymore.
And there's 360 deals where they got to take a piece of merch and things like that. And again, yeah, a lot of it you can relate to the illegal downloads back in early 2000s, 2004, when iTunes came out and all that stuff, and Napster and all that stuff back in the day. Yeah, so there's less money in song sales. But so then, okay, so now let's focus on touring and let's focus on, you know, basically, you know, our brand. You know, again, things we're doing, more shows, more merch, things like that. And in order to do that, so, yeah, label support, it's up in the air. There are some new labels I know that are coming out that are doing really well, and we are keeping those in mind. And right now we're still DIY, but if they can make a decent offer, it's all depending on how you negotiate the deal, and you got to obviously, you know, really check the, you know, fine print. You might be able to work out where they can help you, but at the same time, you got to really count on your own. And again, it's just yeah, the times have changed. You know, until there's a new model, which some labels are working on, some of these newer labels are coming out with better models to deal with the fact that, you know, they song sales aren't the main profit. It's going to have to be touring, and it's going to have to be merch and things like that. So you just have to kind of accept that, and that's fine. There is money to be made, you know, enough for everybody to be happy and still make a living. Again, it's definitely different and harder, but that's why you got to work harder.
Now, if you remember a few years ago, Interscope Records gave the band U2, like, redid their record deal and basically gave them whatever they want plus $60 million each. I mean, do you think those days are over?
I mean, one in a billion chance, because you're talking about U2. They've been around forever.
Biggest band in the world.
Yeah, worldly huge.
You know? Like Metallica, you know, they're one of the biggest bands in the world, you know, and it's so, for them, yeah, that's they can call the shots, you know, they're a huge band. They got so many fans that everybody's, you know, profiting off that. Everybody's going to, you know, get results from that. But so the band's on the rise, yeah, it's a tougher deal. You know, the band's you know, coming up, or it's a tougher deal. But if you're a big band from back then, yeah, you're, you know, everybody's still going to benefit.
Yeah, and then the first album they make for that deal, they give away for free on iTunes.
Yeah.
I know, I remember that was interesting. And I know some artists, I think, had an issue with that, because then they felt like, oh, well, shoot, they're just giving away for free now. Yeah, so they're not, you know, they're kind of just putting down the dollar idea.
It did kind of cheapen the album, I think. You know, because I mean, think about it. Like, I don't know if you guys are YouTube fans or not, but every album they did before that, like, you heard months in advance, oh, we're almost done, and all this pressure built up and stuff, and then it was dropped, and everybody rushes and get it. You know, this time it's like, what the fuck's this doing in my iPhone when I woke up this morning?
Yeah,
I agree with that, man. I mean, a cup of coffee, what, is a couple dollars, and a song is only a dollar that takes thousands of dollars to make, so... You know, you think about it, I would still, you know, this is still charged just based on the benefit that it's the song is worth something, you know?
Yeah, exactly. Well, because when you buy something, you appreciate it more than if it's just given to you.
Yeah. That's always been the case. I used to sell tickets back in the day sometimes for a show back when I did pay to play once in a band in Hollywood. And it's, if I'd offered for free, they wouldn't want as much. But if I say it costs a dollar, they want it. So I don't know what that concept worked, but I was like, okay, I'll charge for it then.
Exactly. Now, do you think the era, you know, going back to like the U2 situation, Rolling Stones, stuff like that, do you think the era of the supergroups is over?
Supergroups. Interesting question.
I think Linkin Park is a supergroup. I recently saw Limp Bizkit. They got back together. I consider them a supergroup. I mean, Metallica is definitely a supergroup. We just played with Slayer at Rocklahoma. They're definitely a supergroup.
But if you're talking about, like, new artists coming up, too, Ryan, like, well, I hope we can be a supergroup. Yeah. That's our plan. And, I know what you're saying. Like, the overall, you know, biggest band in the world. And again, you got to remember, there's, I get kind of deep with this stuff. You know, there's a bigger population these days. What are we, over 8 billion people? And the entertainment business and industry is saturated now. You know, we got comedy, we got, you know, movie premieres, and film is huge these days, you know, but music is, everybody still will always love music. So they still want music. And so, you know, I think there are some still big bands out there. Again, that are coming up, and to be like a legacy band, you know, a band that everybody will always remember. Hopefully, we could be that band, or some other bands that I know that are great, hopefully could get to that status and keep that. That's it's hard to say, but I would think there's still some bands that people will always remember and could be bands that are remembered forever.
Exactly. Now, here's something to think about, too. When the Chimps are eligible for the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, we will have crossed 10 billion people.
Nice.
Yeah, that's, yeah, that's a goal. Right on. That's an easy goal.
So, yeah, that there's also talk. There's also people worrying about there being a food shortage by that time too. So, you know,
well, maybe we can feed them with the money we make.
Yeah, you know? Edible CDs or something too. That'd be cool.
Yeah, yeah, we'll grow more vegetables then.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Now, how do the chimps utilize social media to get your product out there?
Pretty much just use it every day. I mean, we like to set things up, like even the recent release of Right to Left, you know, we set up an event page a couple weeks ago and just kept throwing little teasers, whether it was a picture of a clip from the video or whatever. You know, we had a TV crew come out and do a, you know, behind the scenes filming of the video when we actually did it. So they put together a little, you know, video clip. So, you know, we had 2 weeks of just sort of inviting all these people to this one page because they know that we're going to be releasing it on this certain date and kind of teasing them a little bit. And, you know, once we did the release, it blew up, you know. I remember looking at YouTube. I think we really set it to public early in the morning, and I remember, you know, early afternoon, I looked at the numbers, and I was already at, like, you know, 400 or 500 views or whatnot, and it kind of blew me away.
Nice.
Yeah.
Now, I get a lot of queries from bands that say, you know, well, I think I post too much because now I'm not getting likes, or I don't think I post enough, you know, because people are asking me questions on Facebook now. What do you think is a good rule of thumb for posting your stuff online?
You definitely don't want to oversaturate it. I mean, if you're in a band and you have a band page, obviously the members should have their own personal pages. And we sort of had, you know, we've agreed to a form. We've had this formula for a while, where if it's something important, if we're promoting a new video or a new song or a show or whatever it is, you know, a series of shows, you know, a concert schedule or whatnot, our tour schedule or whatnot, we'll usually post it, agree to post it first on our band page, and then everyone on their own pages could share it from that page, which inevitably will bring traffic back to your page because it says at the top so-and-so shared, you know, this band's post or whatever, you know.
Yeah,
And it seems to work. You know, Facebook keeps changing. That's the thing that's hard about Facebook. If we're only talking about Facebook, is they're always changing their formats and the rules, you know. Like I even noticed on our page, you know, we've got, you know, well over 10,000 fans on there. And we used to get, you know, hundreds of likes and all these comments. But last year, since the formats have changed, we personally are getting more attention on our personal pages than the actual band page. Because now, yeah, you know, Facebook has this thing where you have to go up to notification button. You got to actually click on it and click get notifications. And this is something they did on their own. So now all our fans that we have, we've made announcements about it here and there, but there's a lot of people out there that don't know that. They're like, why aren't I seeing posts from the chimps? That's why you got to go click that notifications button, click get notifications. Which
you definitely don't want to be not active. I mean, you definitely do not posting enough. That's not good. But overposting, I mean, you know, someone actually gave me a number one time, like a consultant was like, you know, post twice a day or something about something. But it's really, judge it by your fans too. And you know, you kind of got to practice, especially if you're a new band, kind of seeing what the reaction is, you know. But yeah, you don't want to overdo it.
Yeah,
know?
I was told there's three times. There's three prime times on, you know, when you're prime online, times, depending on what, you know, time code you're in. It's usually morning traffic, which you have 2 to 3 hours, you know, before it trickles off. And then there's an hour in the midday, you know, for people at work and our lunch and all checking their iPhones and stuff. And obviously traffic at the end of the night. Those are the prime times that have actually worked for us. But I want to go more than three posts a day. You know, if you're going to keep drilling and drilling and drilling, and you've only got, you know, even if you only got 1,000 fans or 500 fans, they're just going to keep seeing it, seeing it, seeing it. They actually might block you eventually because they don't get tired of seeing the same posts over and over and over.
And one thing, don't write like way too much in a post because people aren't going to read so much, you know.
Yeah, whenever I see the read I always just keep going.
Right. So, I mean, you know, and people love pictures. You know, that's why Instagram does so well. People love pictures, they love videos. You know, they won't read a lot, but if they're your fans, they will read some. So just, but you know, keep it short and simple.